Hey guys, this is Robert Breedlove from the What is Money Show. And as you've learned by watching this show, Bitcoin is the single most important asset you can own in the 21st century. And one of the most important companies in Bitcoin today is NYDIG. NYDIG's mission is to facilitate financial security for all. They accomplish this by bringing a high level of professionalization and sophistication to the Bitcoin marketplace. As a true game changer in the industry, NYDIG is safely unlocking the power of Bitcoin for forward-thinking individuals and institutions alike. By using NYDIG, you will gain access to an end-to-end institutional-grade platform, providing Bitcoin OTC transactions, Bitcoin collateralized borrowing, secure custody, asset management, derivatives, financing, market research, and more. And all of these services meet the highest regulatory, governance, and audit standards. Led by Robbie Gutman, Yin Zhao, and Ross Stevens, NYDIG has absolutely exploded onto the Bitcoin scene recently and is leading the way for ongoing institutional adoption in this nascent asset class. So please be sure to check out NYDIG as a single source for all your Bitcoin needs. Welcome back to the What is Money Show. I am honored to be sitting down today with a brilliant mind in the Bitcoin space, Mr. Max Hillebrand. And today we're going to be exploring, starting what's probably going to be a long exploration of the book Ethics of Liberty by Murray Rothbard. Max, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Robert. I'm looking forward, as always, to our conversations. This is going to be a fun one.
Yeah. I think most of my audience probably knows who you are. Maybe you could just give a brief introduction about yourself, your background, your relationship to Bitcoin, and then maybe a brief introduction to the book as well.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. My background really is more in economics and the science of entrepreneurship. That has always fascinated me for several reasons. Just because as a young boy, I started out, you know, growing up as an entrepreneur, needing to earn my money to spend on all those fancy things that I wanted to have. And then after realizing that, well, you actually need to work and sacrifice in order to have capital that you can spend on all the fancy leisure goods that you would like. And that was a very valuable lesson to learn at first. And then, of course, once you realize that there is a cost, well, then you want to be as efficient as possible in allocating your resources, right? So this was why economics was always very interesting to me. Yeah. At first, then I found, you know, the Keynesian mainstream bullshit, and that quickly turned out to be a very, well, inadequate description of the problems that I was facing. And that led me to try to seek alternative ways of answering economic questions. And here, of course, the Austrian school and praxeology is first and foremost, and that's what I found very appreciative. And that was even before discovering Bitcoin. So I was aware of the problem and the magnitude of the problem, and then was looking for solutions to the problem of money. And then discovering Bitcoin is, of course, a great relief. You know, ever since then, I've been focusing more on trying to understand the nuances of the economics of this incredibly novel monetary asset, and also the technological aspect, right? And what it actually means to use these technologies, and not just to use them, but to help out in building them. So that's been quite a fun ride over these last years to help shape these new technologies that we use, right? To build the shovels, so to say, for this new gold rush.
Beautiful. Yeah, like you, I kind of discovered it wasn't Austrian economics for me. It was central banking. I went down the Creature from Jekyll Island rabbit hole prior to Bitcoin. Had been looking for solutions ever since. Had somewhat given up, and until I found Bitcoin, and the rest is history, as they say. So again, we're talking about this book, The Ethics of Liberty, by Murray Rothbard. Murray is a notable Austrian economist. He is a student of Mises. Please correct me on any of this, by the way. But as I understand it, he's a student of Mises, American guy. He wrote the book Man, Economy, and State, which I've heard is the next best thing to human action, which was written by Mises and is essentially, in my view, the Bible of Austrian economics. I have not read Man, Economy, and State. So actually, starting this conversation with you, you've encouraged me to jump in and read more Rothbard. And he's got a way with words, to say the least.
Oh, he does.
Yeah. Maybe we could start, if you could either perhaps tell us a little bit about the book, and we could start with a definition that I think is foreign to most people outside of the Austrian school, which is praxeology.
Yeah, this book really is a monumental treatise. Murray liked writing these really long form books, you know, that start with a description of the methodological approach, a description of the axioms, the fundamental starting point, and then building a monumental construct with mainly logical, verbal deductive reasoning on top of that. And something like Man, Economy, and State really sets out very similar to Human Action to bring this, well, entire treatise of way of economic thought into light. And it's extremely broad in its consequences to explain the logic of human action, right? This is what praxeology means. And what it basically seeks to explain is, well, the human condition. And what does it mean for humans to act? That's in the word of the science itself, right? And here is, for one, it entails individual existence, right? And this is one of the starting differentiations in, for example, the methodology of praxeology to other schools of thought. This was famous in the Methodenstreit among Eugen von Böhmerwerk, Ludwig von Mises, and others, to state that economics is fundamentally an individualistic science, right? And that the individual is the proper unit of analysis for economic problems, which is very much not a mainstream view, right? The mainstream is very much that one of a collective one, where the starting axiom is a group, right? And aggregated numbers are the methodology used. Yeah. So praxeology is an analysis of the individual problem, right, with the individual as a starting point. And then it's not just that the individual exists, but it's that he is in a state of uneasiness, as Ludwig von Mises put it. Right? Basically, you have a bunch of problems. You're hungry, for example, and it's cold and raining, and there are a bunch of weird men with swords after you. Right? So there are a lot of problems to be solved. And now you need to figure out easy solutions to them. But that's already the genius part of the entrepreneur, is that you live in this miserable place right now, and you still have the genius to envision a potential of a future that is less miserable than it is right now. Right? You can think of not just one, but of numerous scenarios that would improve your situation. And one of Karl Menger's original insight in subjective theory of value is that the individual himself can now rank order each of these potential scenarios so that you can establish the most important thing to be doing right now. Right? The thing that will give you the most value, the most utility, so to say, marginally more than any other thing. And this is ultimately what the individual chooses to act upon, right? It's to manifest that solution to the most difficult problem in the most elegant way. Right? That is somewhat of the individual trade-off that goes into contemplating every possible action, right? And praxeology is now to analyze the consequences of these actions, so to say, and not just for the consequences of one individual human action, but instead even of a society, of an economy, of a free market, of a vast, uncountable number of individuals collaborating in utmost complex, networks, that this still works and shows how the governing consequences, so to say. That in and of itself is praxeology. And economics is one small part of praxeology, And for example, it was very well outlined in Human Action and Man, Economy and State. And this is now the major contribution of this specific book, Ethics of Liberty, is that Murray Rothbard did what his master thought was impossible. Because economics is per se a wertfreie analysis, a value-free economics. Mm. Right? It's not like psychology, which talks about what people value, right? Or what they should value somewhat is ethics. But rather, economics tells about the consequences of human action. Right? Mm. So it's not about which ends you should choose, but it's about what are the means necessary in order to reach your end. That's more the question of economics answers. And ethics is always a very different thing. And Mises thought that ethics cannot be explained with a priori reasoning, as praxeology is, right? To start with that fundamental axiom that humans act and deduce from there. But what Murray Rothbard lays out in this approach, and later Hans Hermann Hoppe refines even more, is the argumentation theory of ethics, so that we can actually deduce a rational, value-free ethics simply by the starting point of individual existence and action, and only with deductive reasoning. This was thought to be not possible before this book, and only a crazy radical extremist like Murray Rothbard could have the courage to speak up these crazy ideas, so to say.
Wow, that's very powerful intro. Thank you for that. So a couple of things here. One, you mentioned that Austrian economics takes the individual as its elementary particle, if you will, right? The individual is who acts, not the group necessarily. Where Keynesian economics takes the inverse approach. And in that scenario, we're actually putting group identity in a Keynesian situation, group identity above individual identity. And that tends to lead to really bad outcomes. I think this other point that you bring up there is this, it's scientific in the sense that it's becoming a value-free analysis, right? So it's trying to tell you about the actual consequences of human action, and I guess in the broadest patterns, without telling you what specifically a human should do. So a science will tell you what is, whereas a religion or philosophy, I think I might be wrong here, will tell you what ought to be, right? Or what you ought to do. So this is much more of a science in that sense. And then I was just wondering, so you make the point too, that all action is essentially an expression of value. That it's a little bit confusing because we say it's human action is expressing value, but it's a science. As a science, it's trying to be value free. Maybe you could just walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's, you know, that the original insight of Karl Menger was that the individual himself has the ability to construct this potential value differentiation, right? So what's the most valuable thing that you could possibly do? And this doesn't even necessarily have to happen consciously. And you don't even need to be able to kind of justify or, you know, prove all of these potential things in your own individual preference scale. That's probably not even possible. But what we can do with a praxeological viewpoint is to look at an action after the fact that it happened, and we can observe certain things about this action. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's not that much of a future prediction of what would people like to have in the future, or how are people going to act in the future, but rather it's more like, this is how a person acted. What does that mean? Like, what does that tell us about the value proposition of that person? And also, classical example, you have an individual with the choice on the table. He has either a loaf of bread with some soy in the middle, or a delicious ribeye steak. Right now, the question is, which of those two do you prefer? And we don't have to debate about some psychology of, you know, maybe you had a dramatic encounter with soy when you were a child or something. Mm-hmm. There might be numerous reasons why you would prefer the one over the other. But ultimately, when you as a free individual walk up to that table and eat the ribeye steak, well, that is a proof that you prefer ribeye steak marginally over a soy burger. And at the very least, that's what we can say. I don't know why you love the steak more than the burger. That's, again, the realm of psychology. But I know that at least you value it more than the other thing. And so that's the kind of observatory statement of values. And again, it's value-free because I'm not making a judgment whether it's good or bad to eat the steak, right? I'm not applying my own valuations over your action, so to say. Right. I'm simply stating that because you chose to eat the steak, it means that you valued it more than the banana. Mm. And that's just a logically correct sentence.
That makes sense. So the action itself is an expression, the individual expressing his value, the valuing ribeye more than soy, for instance. But then the observation of that action is value-free. And then we're just saying, clearly he preferred the ribeye to the soy. So there's no subjectivity in that observation.
Exactly, yes. And one thing to consider as well is that the individual thinks a priori, right, before the action, before he takes the action, that he will prefer the steak to the banana. Right? Because, well, maybe on, again, multiple reasons for that, his past experience and whatnot. But maybe it turns out, you know, that even though the steak looks great on the outside, it's actually rotten within, right? Or completely overcooked, right? Yeah. And then after eating the steak, you know, in hindsight, the person can say, oh, well, actually, I think I should have eaten the banana or the burger, right? That would have been more satisfactory for myself.
Right.
But, well, that's, you know, an entrepreneurial error, so to say. You wanted to solve a problem, hunger, right? That was the end goal. And now you had different means at your disposals, right? Yes. A burger and a steak. And now you as the entrepreneur make the resource allocation of which means to utilize to reach your given ends. Yes. And you thought that steak was better than banana, but turned out that's not the case.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. The useful analogy I've heard put forth to you, because this is takes kind of a shift in perspective to understand this, is praxeology is more like Euclidean geometry in a way, where it just has these, you know, Euclidean geometry has these five theorems or axioms from which it reasons all of its other, makes all of its other assertions that are then provable from those axioms. And it seems to me like at least the economics portion, I'm not sure if this applies to praxeology more generally, that it's similar, right? It's making these assertions, one of which is man must act, I think is a very important one. And then it just deduces from there what would happen. So it's not empirical in the sense that you go out and make observations of all the men acting in the world to determine that man must act. I mean, I guess you technically are making it from observation. That's kind of a bad example, actually. The example I like from Euclidean geometry is, you know, one of the theorems is two parallel lines never touch. So you don't go out and prove that by observing all the parallel lines in nature. You're making an axiomatic assumption effectively. And then from that assumption, you're building this worldview. And it seems like praxeology is similar.
Exactly. Yes. It's somewhat of setting boundaries out of the infinite abyss, you know, of the unlimited potential. You need to somehow set boundaries for the arena that you want to play in.
Yes.
And Ludwig von Mises brings up in his great book, Theory and History, which goes a lot into the epistemology and methodology of economics. He brings up, for example, that you can look at a stone, right? And that's an object that you can observe, right? And you can even make predictions on its behavior, right? Or on, you know, if you drop it from the air, it's going to fall down, and that's going to happen all the time the same, right? Because the rock itself is an object, right? It's incredibly interesting, and just analyzing the physics of this is very important, and of course many people do, but it's important to realize that it's just fundamentally different when we talk about falling stones than when we talk about acting humans. Right? One is this inanimate object that just reacts, so to say, or it
reflexive behavior, I think they call it.
Exactly. Yes. Right. And with humans, there is instead this way that we can, you know, actually make rational decisions and rational analysis on our problems and a focused effort on alleviating them. Right. And when this is all of a sudden a whole other game of analysis, right? So to say that we have our starting point of the conversation is that humans act, right? That is a lot different conversation than to say stones fall when you drop them.
Yes. Right? Yes. Yes. There's, I think he distinguishes between, again, this word action. It's very important to understand that there's a purpose or intention behind it, which is distinguished from the reflexive behavior in a human of, you know, the doctor hits your knee with a hammer and your leg kicks out. There's not really an intention or purpose behind that. It's just reflexive. I guess we could say that the falling of the stone is somewhat of a reflexive behavior too. It always plays out that way. So that gets us into one extremely important concept underlying really all freedoms in the world, is this concept of property. And people often think of property as something, you know, like a piece of land or stock or something outside of themselves, which it can be. I actually argue that property is the relationship between the individual and the thing. But another piece that most people are oblivious to is that you are your most personal property. You, your body, your time. Maybe you could walk us through that concept of property.
Yeah, I think that's so important to understand. And as you say, property goes as deep as the person's own body and existence. So so why is that? Let's build a theory of property in the Rothbardian tradition, so to say. So as we established, we start with the assumptions that humans act. And so they exist, they have problems, they're suffering, they can think of a better future. And now they can act in order to solve their problems, right? So for example, when you're hungry, you can walk over the table, right, and pick up some food and eat it, right? But what does that actually mean? It basically means that your spirit, so to say, is maneuvering your physical body, right? That vessel in meat space, so to say, you can control and manipulate. You as the individual have a use, an exclusive use, even an exclusive power to use, right? So that nobody else but you can, in fact, move your arms and control that body. But one interesting thing is that this is now a potential conflict of ownership, right? Because if you are the only one that can control this body, well, that means that other people cannot. Right? And they might not be happy that you don't do what you want, what they want you to do. Mm. And so this potential of conflict means that we need to somehow figure out a solution. Right? And it, this goes not as far as the control over the scarce resource over your body. Right? That there are other very many important scarce resources. Right? Your food, for example, the land that you stand on. Right? The clothes that you wear, the tools that you use to solve your problems. There are many scarce resources which have this exclusivity of ownership, right? So that only one individual can use the scarce resource in his problem-solving process of resource allocation. And because only one person can use it, and because there are not enough total quantity of that good available for everyone to enjoy the use, right? That is what makes it scarce, that puts these goods into a potential conflict. Mm. And whenever two people have a conflict over something, right, we need to find a problem resolution to this. And there are, as Rothbard lays out, only three potential options to consider in the question of who can use these scarce resources that are at our disposal. Right? The first solution is that, well, nobody or rather everybody can use these scarce resources, right? So that for whenever someone wants to use anything, we need to come to a complete collective consensus, you know, that this person gets to, you know, eat the steak. That might in theory be maybe possible. I'm not sure considering the speed of light, so probably not. But it, at least in practice, it's very much impossible to find consensus over any large number of groups, at least, you know, 8 billion for everything, for everything, for every allocation of every scarce resource.
That would be everyone voting for everyone else's action all the time.
Exactly.
That's impossible.
Like, that's just not how the work works, right? Yeah. That's just not true. It's not accurate.
Yes.
So the second option is that some select group of individual gets to decide about the resources and other people do not. Right? So this is the classical master and slave relationship. Right? The master owns the property in the body of the slave. And he gets to keep the fruits of the labor of whatever the slave focuses his energy on. Right? And this fails because, as Rothbard points out, what we want to find here is a universal ethic, right? A natural law ethic, something that is universal and applies for every man equally. Right? That is required for a universal rational ethic to be reasonable. And this fails on that front, right? If you have some masters taking the stuff from others, that's not equal rights for everyone. So it kind of falls out from our level of analysis as well. There are, in more detailed analysis, numerous problems with socialism like this, especially calculating in a complex market economy becomes impossible without property rights and free exchange and prices. But that's a more in-depth argument later. But ultimately, so the final answer to the question of who can control these resources, well, is every sovereign individual by himself can allocate those scarce resources that he has justly acquired, as Rothbard points out in this book multiple times. And justly acquired is essential here, right? So there are two ways where an individual can justly acquire property according to this option. The first is by homesteading, basically by finding abundant, scarce resources available in nature and by being the first individual to actively use them and to claim them. And so the obvious example would be you walk in a public forest and there is a tree with some apple and you just take it and eat it. There's nobody else that would like to eat it. Right? So you can just eat it. There's nobody else to make a claim, right? Or for example, with your body, right? To be a bit even more fundamental. These are a bunch of atoms that were growing in the womb of your mother and somehow your consciousness stumbles into that bodily vessel and you're the only one to use it. Right? So that's... that gives you kind of some homesteading, at least of your body, at the point of birth, arguably even before. And that is that's the first way to acquire just property, by being the first one to use it, right? By, as Jordan Peterson would say, by venturing out into the unknown chaos and uncertainty of the future or of nature, right? And taming that. Placing this into a border that you have defined, a map that you've created, and by using these natural given resources to solve your problems. Right? That is a way to acquire the property. And the other way to do that is if it was not you to have homesteaded these unused resources, but someone else, and he has voluntarily given up those resources that he has homesteaded for you. Right. And as long as that handing over of the right to use these scarce resources in a productive exchange economy, that's important. And now this is finally where I can answer your great question of what is property, right? To define that. Property is not the scarce resource itself. Property is a legal framework over who has the right to use a certain scarce resource and who has not the right, who is excluded from the legal right to use a certain resource. And this is fundamentally somewhat of a social construct, right? Because it is conflict theory, and conflict only arises among individuals. arguably, at least on the level of analysis here, mm-hmm. Ultimately, even you are made up of a group of individuals across time, at least. Mm-hmm. And there is rivalry across that level of analysis as well. Mm. But for the legal framework, what we're interested here is conflict among multiple individuals over where to and how to use scarce resources. And property rights are now alienable rights to use scarce resources. So when you have the property right title in a certain scarce resources, mm-hmm. it means that you can control how to use it. Mm-hmm. But this is not an unalienable right like your free will, mm-hmm. but rather an alienable right that you can give away to others. Right? I can sacrifice my consumption of the steak by instead giving the property right of how to choose where to use that steak to Rob, right? And then Rob goes and eats the steak himself because he has acquired the property right title to choose where to allocate these scarce resources. And so what happens in free exchange amongst individuals, it's not that we physically, you know, exchange goods and services at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's not about the actual meat space transfer. Right. It's more about that social construct over who has actually the right to use these resources.
The transfer of titles.
Yeah. Exactly, the transfer of titles. That's what makes property rights such a massive innovation, because it just, you know, gives this way to exchange much more easier, not relying only on possession, but more on a social construct of ownership.
Right. And so the alienability then is essentially the exchangeability, right? You can't trade away your free will, but you can trade away your ribeye. And that's sort of at the basis of the efficiency gains capitalism produces, right? That is the division of labor, that we can trade these fruits of labor and create more output per unit of input. That's why it's an effective resource strategy, effectively, when adhered to. But the issue here, and this is a very deep topic. So the property itself, unless it's a pure, really, it comes down to its defensibility almost. Can you defend the asset? If you cannot personally defend it, if it's not a bare asset that you can individually command and control, then you're dependent on the security framework, the physical security framework in your area, right? And the legal system that's attached to it. So property, most property then always, and I'm going to lay all this out and then please come back and correct anything I'm saying wrong here, but most property then is dependent upon the local monopoly on violence, right? So if anyone transgresses against that relationship between you and the property, you have recourse to the legal system or to force to correct that transgression. But the problem here, at least in my view of history, is that, okay, so there's the local monopoly on violence. Its express purpose is really to preserve peace and property, right? Life, liberty, property, essentially. That's what government's function is. But because it's in a monopolist position, it always charges monopoly prices over time, over long enough time scales. So taxes and or inflation tend to always increase. And when you hit a 100% tax rate, you are a slave. That's what it is. So you could define a slave as someone taxed at 100%, right? All of their property is going to someone else. Effectively, all the fruit of their labor is taxed at 100%. So anywhere you are on that gradient, you're just moving towards slavery, effectively. So is property then, everything outside of bare assets, is premised on this logic of violence in a way? Am I thinking about that correctly?
I think it's down the right alley in a couple aspects, right? So, but one important thing to highlight is that property rights exists even, or disregarding if there is a mafia or a politicized group of violence, like a gang of thieves writ large, as Murray Rothbard would like to say. Property rights exist for the isolated individual, Robinson Crusoe on the Lonely Island. And even at that level of analysis, property rights exist. Mm-hmm. Right? They are non-man-made, immutable, and unescapable, right? Conditions that govern the behavior of human action, so to say. So this is a very much of a natural law type of negativist approach rather than a man-made positivist approach. Right. So positivism, and this is again the basis of the Methodenstreit in the 18th, 19th century. But basically, positivism would say that again, a group of individuals can decree what is morally right to do. Right. And this decree can be made different for different people in that economy. Right. So some people can get privilege rights that other people don't have. Mm-hmm. And those privilege rights are handed out by the ruling class. Right. So here rights are granted by the masters, so to say. And that is very, very different to the natural law ethics that Rothbard describes in this book, right? That are again non-man made. Right. Mm-hmm. They are not created. These are not rules created by men in a social construct, so to say. This is more that humans can discover these laws, just the way that they can discover Euclidean geometry or gravity, right? That they are objective in the sense that they don't change for individuals across space or time. Right? Gravity was the same 100 years ago in Paris as it is today in the United States, right? It's the same always, and it doesn't change based on, for example, national borders, which are just arbitrary lines after all. So that just all means that property, just as money, is not a creation of the state, and it shouldn't be portrayed as such. But on the other hand, like, what does it mean to have the exclusive right to use something, right? If you are violated in that right. And that is the combination of two kind of sacred principles within this school of ethics. And that is, for one, the feminine aspect of non-aggression, meaning to not initiate aggressive force against the justly acquired property of an individual, right? That is the feminine, right? Do not steal, the one single rule that Rothbard proposes in this ethic, and right? Respect the property of others. But that goes hand in hand. It's the other side of the coin of the masculine principle of self-defense. If you do not have the right to take the property of someone else, then you do have the right to apply any force necessary, even to the point of lethal force, to stop an individual to unjustly take the property from you. Right? That defense, as the act is happening in the here and now, is justly, absolute just and morally like recognized. But the problem of, are you morally justified to take defensive actions, and do you have the physical power to take defensive actions, are two very different questions. Right? So just because you have a natural right to protect yourself against government thugs coming to steal taxes from you does not mean that you actually have the power to persuade the military-industrial complex to not blow you up. And that's something to be considered. But ultimately, if you have a property right definition that has been acknowledged by the local monopolist of violence, then you have a much higher likelihood of having a peaceful and conflict-free use of your property rights. Right? If someone else would challenge you in your possession of those property rights, and that other person has the backing of the state and not you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you have that huge army knocking on your door, and that's not going to be comfortable.
Right. So I love this topic because I cannot unravel it in my mind. So I'm glad we're digging into it. I love the way you put the non-aggression principle, which is at the bedrock of Rothbard's work, as kind of the yin to the self-defense yang. I think that's a very interesting way to look at it. And so I want to ask this about property rights. So Peterson also has this great saying that every right is someone's responsibility. They also are two sides of the same coin. If you have the right to 3 meals a day, hypothetically, someone has the responsibility to provide those 3 meals a day, right? So, and this applies to everything that we call human rights. So my question about property rights is, whose responsibility is that? It seems to me like it's inseparable from violence or the monopoly on violence, because even in the case of gravity, like gravity's enforced, right? We'd say the enforcer is the law of physics, I suppose. But it seems to me that to have a truly effective property rights system, there has to be some outside enforcer that's resolving disputes, basically making subjective arbitrary judgments about conflicts over property. So how do you, I hear you, like I hear that it's discoverable law. There's a deep principle here, but it seems like to root that back into physical reality requires an enforcer of some kind.
Yeah, I think on the macro scale, nature or the universe is the enforcer. Mm. I think that this relationship is true, that as the morality of a civilization declines, the freedom declines. And as the morality of a nation increases, its freedom increases. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a corollary relationship on the both micro scale as well as the macro scale. So let's go through it through the micro scale. Like Rothbard proposes the one simple rule, do not steal. Okay, so let's go through a thought experiment and break that rule consistently, right? And also, so let's go out and let's rape the child of our neighbor, right? And we're going to steal all the food from the local grocery store, and we're going to burn down the houses, and we're going to burn the books, and let's see how quickly we will be a successful individual in the evolutionary existence. Mm. Let's put it like that. You're going to be an evolutionary mistake very quickly. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I think even on individual level, just thinking through how it would be to continuously steal from others, you can instantly conjure up the most dreadful and horrific imagination and potential outcome that might entail for you personally. Yeah. Right, and that you are ultimately responsible and that you will receive the consequences of these actions.
Right.
The father of the girl you raped will come after you. Yeah. Right. And there will be numerous consequences and you will have to bear them and you cannot escape them.
Right.
This is true on the individual level. And I'm very much convinced that it is true on the collective level.
Right.
As more people ignore, willfully ignore, right? Although they have the information, they deliberately do not use it in their understanding towards truth. When more people ignore the reality that property rights and freedoms and their individual sovereignty are, right, that they simply are a sovereign individual by the fact of their own existence, mm-hmm. even though they might not even know it, but the more you ignore it, the more your sovereignty will be tyrannized and the more the collective prosperity and happiness of the entire economy, of the entire market participants will be devastated. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen that numerous times in history at scale, especially in the 20th century, that when stealing becomes the norm, that the utter, complete collapse of civilization to the point of mass murder and cannibalism is the inevitable conclusion.
Yes, yes. Okay, so that makes sense too. And I agree, the more moral a society becomes, the more freedom it exhibits. I'm not 100% sure if those things aren't reciprocally interacting though, because you might almost also say the more, you know, if we just as Bitcoiners said, okay, clearly a Bitcoin-based society would be way more free. So as a result, it would probably develop a more nonviolent morality, let's say. But I don't know if that's just some principle inherent to life we uncovered, or if that's because Bitcoin as a money is actually, it's a new variable in the logic of violence calculus occurring in every market actor's mind, right? Everyone's trying to basically meet their ends, right? It's means and ends. But if violence all of a sudden is not as useful of a means, say there's a much higher, a much worse cost benefit ratio to violence because Bitcoin can be stored in multi-sig and, you know, it's hard to steal all these things, then that would push people towards more productive behavior, I think. So it's see like what I'm trying to get at here is there's this, I feel like there's this very practical element to the implementation of property and natural law that really Bitcoin, without Bitcoin, we're always going to be vulnerable to the state. Like so long as you want to occupy property and do all these things, there needs to be an enforcer on the outside. That enforcer is typically a monopolist. It's kind of a naturally monopolizing industry. As it grows old and rigid, it tends to kind of prey on, it seems like it starts to feed on itself. The state almost just feeds on property. You know, it's always trying to grow itself, and that's why it monopolizes money and does all these other things. So without something like Bitcoin, a property that's independent of the monopoly on violence entirely, I feel like we'd just be stuck in this vicious cycle forever until whatever, maybe apocalyptic type situation. And you know, to your point about Rothbard saying that the individual that goes out and rapes and steals and does all these things, he's going to get blotted out pretty quickly from an evolutionary standpoint. I agree with that if an individual runs out and just does that thing spontaneously. But if you look at a dictator, someone that comes into power over the state apparatus, they can do that very thing directly or indirectly for decades, and they can still do really well from an evolutionary standpoint, right? If you're, I think Genghis Khan, who is one of the most ruthless dictators there's ever been, sired like a, you know, you can trace the genealogy back, and I don't know the exact number, 10 or 20% of the world population has some Genghis Khan in them. So we're like, there seems to be this inextricable relationship between our morality and property systems and the technological realities with which we can implement them. Does that make sense? Like I'm just having a hard time accepting Rothbard's principle that like once you discover it, everyone will just accept it. There's some enforceability element to it.
Yes. No, I think that's not a disagreement with Rothbard. Like for one, everyone has to kind of agree with you. That's yes. Again, like this is conflict theory is fundamentally a social theory, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, we need to somehow get into consensus here, but we need to somehow get into agreement with some portion of other people. I don't think that we need to be in 100% agreement. I think that would actually be quite difficult, and I don't think that it's necessary because, again, in the free society, there are numerous options available for every potential solution to any potential problem, right? So many ways to go about it, and not just in potential in time, but also in space, right? Mm-hmm. So you might have a disagreement of who did a crime, you know, based on locality, right? So and that will probably continue to be upheld, right? That it's so difficult to get into consensus on anything. Mm-hmm. Right? That's why Bitcoin is a bloody miracle that it actually mm-hmm. works, right? Mm-hmm. But it's for sure an outlier to the norm. So I think relying, but yes, in any case, I agree to your point that current monopolies of violence focus themselves on the alleviation of the conflict after the fact, right? Mm-hmm. So someone goes around, rapes and murders and pillages, and then afterwards we put him in front of a jury and we condemn him, and then he needs to pay retributions, for example. Mm-hmm. And that's good enough, right? That puts an opportunity cost to an attacker, right? That if he gets caught, and if he gets processed in the criminal system, then he will, he has to pay some amount, right? Mm. So that will hopefully deter more people from not stealing from you in the first place. Mm-hmm. But where's something like, you know, castles, come in. Great technology. I love castles. Castles are not like, let's, you know, ask a jury and then afterwards tell him to please not invade, like that it was wrong that he invaded my castle.
Yeah.
Instead, build really, really, really big walls around your castle. Yes. And many high points advantages to shoot at the enemy. Yeah. Right? That if he ever dares to come, you're going to slap him really hard so that he doesn't come the next time.
Right.
And that he cannot even come to taking the scarce resources that you have at your disposal. Now, but even with a successful defense where the attacker does not loot all of your goods, right, you still suffer the opportunity cost of all the man hours spent in producing the war machinery and manning the army and all the people who died, of course, in the war efforts, right? So it's still a very costly endeavor to have premature defense, so to say. Mm. And now the question is of how costly is this? Because the more costly premature defense is, then it is less useful for, of course, smaller value goods and items and persons, right? If it costs you, I don't know, 100,000 Bitcoin to build your big castle wall, I mean, nobody got 100,000 Bitcoin, right? So you have to save a bunch before you get all that. So, you know, that's one thing. And the beauty of technology in general, but especially technologies of cyberspace and encryption and cryptography, right? They enable you to build defenses that are so cheap to generate, you know, in the millisense of electricity produced and computational hardware, it's trivially cheap. But then to attempt to break the protections provided by the algorithm is infinitely hard. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is very cheap preemptive defense and very expensive potential overcoming of the defensive measures. And Bitcoin is, of course, the same. As encryption is for money, encryption is for words, Bitcoin is now for money, mm-hmm. right? That it's incredibly cheap to receive Bitcoin. Right? Literally, to receive it, it's basically nothing because the sender pays the cost in the first place. Yeah. But, it, you know, that's just amazing. And then to spend your Bitcoin, right? And to spend your Bitcoin, if you actually know the secret to your private key, is it's still easy, right? But if you would want to spend the Bitcoin without knowing the secrets, without knowing the private keys, that's just literally impossible with how Bitcoin is designed as a holistic system. And so Bitcoin is so powerful precisely because it addresses that area that you mentioned, that preemptive retributional justice is not good enough. Right. It will always be reliant on the support of the majority, a monopoly of violence. And it will always come at a massive opportunity cost of human time and life. And when you have the power to preemptively protect yourself, especially when it's cheap to set up and very expensive to break, then that's an all out win. And it will help smaller value transactions and individuals to be protected.
Yeah, it reminds me of the old wisdom, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure type of thing. I can't stop thinking about that from this book. It's like, how do you... I just don't feel like there is a way to construct a sustainable civilization absent Bitcoin. If anything, this book has reinforced my bullishness on the indispensability of Bitcoin, frankly, for scaling human cooperation.
That's the beautiful thing, that Bitcoin is powerful enough in its architectural defenses that it can even stand up to the monopolist of violence.
Yes.
The biggest mafia guy on the block.
Right.
Right. Not just the United States government, but the Chinese government and all other corrupt governments in this world.
Yes.
Are actively trying to, as much as possibly, end the Bitcoin system.
Right.
And they keep failing.
Yes.
And that is really what makes it so beautiful. That
yes.
It simply disregards the monopolist of power.
right,
of violence. You yes. have no power in this realm.
Right. Another way I've been thinking lately is that players inside of a game, they're going to organize their strategies around the invariants, right? The things they can't control. So you could say that, we talked about gravity earlier. Gravity is clearly an invariant, and all of life is trying to organize a strategy against gravity. You know, trees are growing towards the sun, birds are flying, we're going to the moon, whatever. In the socioeconomic sphere, historically, gold was that invariant. So it was like the thing that no one could really do anything about. It was selected as money because it was, and again, all the individual self-interest. But because gold, because of the economic properties of gold, there are advantages to centralizing it. So when you centralize it, you're actually enriching, and you're centralizing it and securing it. So you're enriching the monopoly on violence. So you're actually incentivizing violence in the world by really building your system on gold. And it gets way worse once you start abstracting that into layer two paper, and then you break the link, and the violence just goes berserk like we're in today. So it seems to me like that's another way to look at Bitcoin. It's like, it's the emergence of a new invariant. You know, no one can change Bitcoin. So now everyone has to adapt their strategy to it at every scale. And it just, I just don't think human beings, I don't think as a species we could evolve past politics and violence being the alpha and omega of human organization without Bitcoin. And that just blows my mind every time I think about it.
Yeah, it's for sure a really big claim, right? Kind of audacious to make. as a counterpoint, like Bitcoin is just a technology, and technology are worth nothing if not used by individuals.
Yes.
And if individuals don't perceive the problems that Bitcoin is designed to solve, and if those individuals don't have the courage to even pick up Bitcoin as a black market tool to enable the liberty that they might only potentially want in the first place, Bitcoin dies if nobody cares about freedom. And it will be forgotten. I'm afraid that the answer to freedom is never as easy as, hey, let's just all use this latest technology. I think that the struggle between good and evil, between morally correct and wrong actions and behavior, as Solzhenitsyn said, goes right through the heart of every individual. And that is as inherent to the nature and creation of men as well anything is, right? So, to be honest, I would probably hate a world that, or I at least I cannot imagine a world where conflict would be entirely alleviated, because that is just fundamentally not how the human condition is unfolding or manifesting to me right now. Yes. Like, life is suffering on many levels. Mm-hmm. And if it no longer were suffering, then what would we do? And as Peterson says again, pick up the heaviest load that you can bear to carry.
Yes.
And that's, I think, rings very true. And that's why I'm not even sure if I would want to have a world where all the conflicts are solved, let alone if I think that Bitcoin is actually going to bring us to that point.
Yes, I should probably condition my phrase there that I don't think Bitcoin just ends violence. I just more currently we operate in the shadow of state violence, right? That is the invariant that controls most of our behavior. I just think more of human behavior will become self-directed, because it will be more empowered, frankly. So the conflicts, it would go from large scale, semi-infrequent, but very disastrous conflicts like World War I, World War II, to much smaller scale, localized, short duration conflicts. It's just like the free, this is the free market principle versus socialism, right? Where you're in a socialist society, you can delay volatility. But eventually the whole thing blows up, right? The plan just keeps diverging further and further from economic reality until it collapses. Whereas in free market capitalism, you have these constant errors getting corrected, little blowups here and there, little forest fires here and there instead of the big blaze. So I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is that it doesn't eliminate violence clearly, but it definitely changes the incentive structure and scale of violence related to violence. So
exactly. Well, yes. And that's, you know, basically the thesis of the sovereign individual.
Yes, book, exactly. Right?
That strong encryption and a strongly encrypted monetary network is very much changing the picture of the game.
Yeah.
Like it's really crazy because Bitcoin replaces that concept of a state protecting property rights as the monopolist of violence simply by, you know, math. Property yes. rights being protected by computation, by, you know, yes. by cryptography, and by individuals having, you know, secret knowledge, right. some passphrase, so to say. And of course, you know, the many incredibly fractal, crazy aspects that make Bitcoin possible. But all of that together, it works, disregarding of the state and its locational meat space boundaries. And that is, it's massively different. It changes a lot. But yeah, you know, to be honest, I can very much see a world where nation states go crazy with all out wars to actually conquer, you know, Bitcoin wealth of others. Because even though theft is not possible within the blockchain, right? So every coin that was ever spent in the Bitcoin blockchain has a valid witness script. Right, a signature, a multi-signature, a hash pre-image, or whatever was defined, but not a single transaction in the blockchain spent a coin without having the explicit authorization to do so. Right, but that doesn't mean that the person who knew the private keys did voluntarily construct that message. Mm-hmm. Right? It does not prove consent in the literal sense. Right, it only proves that there was a person who knew a message and who had a private key. It does not mean that that person was not violated in his property rights, right? That he was not harassed by others. So of course, right, that's the $5 wrench strategy. Yeah. So unfortunately, Bitcoin does not protect you from that.
Right.
And so ultimately, as long as you have the capability to spend your Bitcoin, even if that is in the most crazy inter-jurisdictional arbitrage multi-sig, right? As long as you have the capability of spending it, other people can apply force to you so that you spend the coin into the address that they want you to spend that in. Sure, if you don't want to, then Bitcoin will make it impossible for them to actually do that. But then you're dead. So, of course, that's the question. But on the other hand, right, then even if you refuse to cooperate and you actually end up dying, well, then the attacker doesn't get the private keys and still right. cannot spend the Bitcoin. So no potential upside. So again, it changes a lot in the nuances and the game theory and the incentive structures, right? And I do think that this will make a substantial and very meaningful impact in the logic of violence or the consequences of violence on the macro scale. It is still like up to question how much it will actually be impacted on the individual case-by-case basis. Just because on the average, it's very not likely that your Bitcoin gets stolen. It might, of course, still be that you are the outlier breaking that rule.